Nearly two-thirds of Americans are overweight or obese, and like our waistlines, that number continues to grow. A new documentary series on HBO looks at how we got so big, the health effects of all that fat, and what we might do to shrink our collective waistline. Executive producer of The Weight of the Nation joins us. Plus, hiding secrets in plain sight. Investigators say they found Al-Qaeda secret files hidden in a porn video. How? We'll talk about the science of steganography. Then disease detectives trace a nasty stomach virus. This will get your attention. And the recycled sounds of the garbage men, five high school kids, and a pile of trash that never sounded so good. All coming up, so stay with us. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last May, German investigators arrested someone they suspected of being an Al-Qaeda operative, and they found out that he was carrying several memory chips, and one of them contained a pornographic video. But when the investigators took a closer look, they found that embedded inside that video file were hundreds of secret documents, maps, memos, plans, and the like. It's called steganography, hiding one piece of information inside of another. And it's a common practice, but how do they do that? Well, joining me to talk about it is Peter Wehner. He's author of the book Disappearing Cryptography, Information Hiding, Steganography, and Watermarking, now in its third edition. He joins me by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you doing?
How do you do that?
Well, you know, it turns out there are lots of little corners in all the information we see. I mean, we're used to the idea that somehow everything we type in the computer is very exact. If you don't type in the right password, the computer gets upset. If you don't type in the right URL, it gets upset. But it turns out that there's lots of little wiggle room that we don't even realize is there. And that's what steganography uses. We kind of go in and we exploit things. You can make a color just a little bit more blue, or you can make it a little bit more red. And then if you do that enough times, you can send a signal. You can put, and then the computer can piece it all together into a complex message.
So you mean, if you, I remember in the old days of computing, way back before there were mice and things, well, that's how old I am, you used to be able to take a file and read the contents of the file with a text reader. And see all the numbers and symbols and things that made up, let's say, the picture file. Are you saying that you could hide code in those little numbers and things that actually make up the file?
Well, most of the time you can. I mean, it depends. If you're sending something very exact, like your account number for your bank, you're not going to want to make a little mistake there.
Right.
But if you're sending a number like, say, the deficit of the United States around and you're off by a little bit, you can hide a lot of different information in the least significant digits off to the right.
Mm-hmm. How much info can you hide?
Well, it depends how much room there is. I've found, it's kind of a trade-off. The more you stick in there, the more the cover file, you could call it, gets degraded. So, but with an image, you can often take over one quarter of the size of the file for your own purposes, and it doesn't start to look too bad. You don't really notice it.
Now, the bad guys must know that you know this technique that they may be using. So is it really always staying one step ahead or one step behind of your opposition?
Both sides of the communication have to know that the technique is there. And that way, if you're sending a message, the person who's receiving it has to know where to look and how to look for it. What's a little bit fascinating about steganography and what's kind of different from some of the other ways we have of communicating is that there are these kind of greater statistical techniques that you can use that give you kind of an indication that maybe there's something that's hidden there, and you might not be able to figure out what the message is, but you can tell that something's just not right with this file.
And you can do that just out of a gut feeling or experience or cracking the file, or how does that work?
Well, it uses statistics. It's kind of a little bit like the whole Moneyball argument that we hear about baseball. but it goes through the file and it looks and it kind of sees that you could say the noise in the image is not right, and it's often a little too random. It's almost a little bit too perfect, you might say.
Right.
And then the statistics comes out and it says, oh, well, you know, it gives you a number and the number is over a threshold, and then you say, oh, well, that's an alarm bell, and I'll look at it.
Mm. There must be an interesting history to this whole steganography idea.
Yeah, people certainly have been playing around with this for, you know, thousands of years, and people have been sneaking messages in lots of different things. I mean, personally, I was kind of inspired by an Edgar Allan Poe short story, The Purloined Letter, and that's why I started to think about how you could do it mathematically. But, people have been, you know, taking this approach for a long time.
Yeah, I noticed that you might be able to I think the Romans shipped a parent blank wax tablets, and then you scrape off the wax, something's in there?
Oh, sure. There are lots of different ways you could do this. In fact, I mean, the story that's floating around, and I'm not sure if it's true or not, I haven't been able to dig deep enough to find out, is that during World War II, the censors would go through and they would kind of change numerical tables. So if somebody was sending a letter to someone in the theater and saying, you know, Johnny got good grades, got an A, B, a C, or something like that, they might change them around a little bit. Mm-hmm. Or they might change, you know, put little changes just in case someone was trying to sneak a message in some table of data.
So what's the difference between steganography? And I'm interested in the origin of the word steganography. Can you take that apart for us?
Well,
Stega? Sounds like a dinosaur.
Yeah, certainly. It goes back to the Greeks, and it
right.
basically means hidden writing.
Right.
And so and what it often gets kind of mixed together with or lumped together with is encryption, and it's kind of they're like close cousins, and they're trying to do the same thing, but they have slightly different approaches.
And that was my next question. What is the difference between steganography and encryption?
Well, there's a lot of overlap, and the scientists like to kind of parse things and make distinctions. The way I like to explain it is, I said, you know, encryption is building the safe, and steganography is trying to find a painting to hide the safe behind.
Interesting. And there must be not sneaky reasons why you would use steganography.
Yeah, there are plenty of reasons. I mean, obviously, anytime you want to communicate with someone in a secret way, you know, may or may not be legitimate. But there are also turning out to be other ways that scientists are using it and engineers are using it. It's a good way for combating counterfeit. And there are these kind of numerical ways that you can go and you can hide, check digits, or you can hide ways. Signatures inside of files, and they operate the same way that the government puts all their little secret signals in cash, or the way that the people try to thwart counterfeiters that way.
Yeah, it's like watermarks.
Yeah, watermarks, exactly.
Yeah.
And then obviously the content industry is very interested in watermarking because they have that hope that this might be able to allow them to kind of combat piracy. And what I've also found is that when you deal with programming, it turns out steganography is very useful because it allows you to kind of add an additional layer of features or data without breaking the old software that was out there. So the old software just deals with the data as if the steganographic message wasn't there, but the new software can come along and it can look in the corners and it can find it, and they can work side by side.
It'd be fun to experiment and fool around with steganography. Is there an app for that that you can sort of make your own? See how it works?
Well, I mean, I just put together a book. I wrote Disappearing Cryptography a while ago, but I put together an iPad version of it, and it's just started. It just reached the iPad store the last week or so. It's called How to Hide Online, and it's a simpler version. I mean, it has some basic text, and then all the illustrations are interactive. You can hide a message with the interactive gadgets that are in the book.
Mm-hmm. And if I were to upload, let's say I make a picture, I hide something in it, and I were to embed something in a movie or on a memory stick, and I want to upload it to Flickr or Facebook or something like that, would it screw up the steganography that's going on there? would the encryption that they do to upload it, would that, and if I want to send it to somebody, would it,
you know, it depends.
Mess it up?
I just sent a, I sent a file this morning, and it got munged, and it got messed up in the in some strange way. But then I sent it a different way, and it went through fine. The Internet's a little bit spooky that way. One thing that does happen with sites like Flickr or with YouTube is that they try to use very advanced compression algorithms to make the files as small as possible. And the advanced compression can be your enemy if you're trying to send a secret message with steganography.
What was it? What was it about this captured Al-Qaeda pornography video that got people's attention and that they thought there might be something in it?
Well, I don't think that they have as much intelligence from Al-Qaeda as they would like. And so I think when I the stories I read, a lot of them concentrated on just what was in these documents. And so I think that was the documents were themselves were the most exciting. I think there's something a little bit ironic in the fact that they chose to hide them in a pornographic movie. So that that will always get you headlines. And I think it's new. We, you know, despite the fact that people have been talking about steganography for a long time, there aren't many real cases that you see come along, you know, as they say, steganography in the wild.
Is there something, place you can study it? Is there, you know, is it a topic you can take in college, or you have to go to special school or military to study this?
Well, you know, there are several books out there. And, you know, some, if you want to take it in college, there are some general courses on encryption, and they often get kind of lumped in there, and they'll spend a week or two on steganography. There are, you know, you can poke around. There, the article on Wikipedia is quite nice, and, mm-hmm. and so, you know, somewhere along all those different choices, you can get a pretty good education.
I have a tweet that came in from Rob I, who says, "You experience steganography every day if you watch digital cable TV." Is that right?
Well, there are lots of different things that the television companies do. Even and it doesn't necessarily have to be digital cable TV. There was a while that there was a gap. Every time your television got to a new, went to a new line, there would be this momentary pause in the broadcast and to allow the electron gun to get back to the left-hand side of your screen again.
Yes.
And for a while, the TV companies were broadcasting extra information in there that they were making some money on because spectrum is so expensive. And it's definitely true that with digital cable TV, the TV companies are doing their best to pack information as best as possible, and they try to have different levels of resolution. And it's kind of an economic game to see how they can pack it all together and see how much see how good the resolution yeah. needs to be to keep people happy.
Yeah. Well, Peter Wader, thank you for taking time to talk about steganography with us.
Sure.
He's author of the book Disappearing Cryptography, Information Hiding Steganography, and Watermarking, now in its third edition. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about how America got supersized and what we can do about it, a new HBO series starting. We'll talk with the producer. And he'll be here to talk about The Weight of the Nation, airing next week. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Ira here, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do, our radio show, podcasts, Facebook, Twitter, and more, if you appreciate that and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to contribute whatever you can by pressing on the donate button on your smartphone or iPad app, or going to our website at sciencefriday.com and making a tax-deductible donation. Thank you. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You've heard these statistics before. Americans are getting fatter and fatter with each passing year, and the trend isn't about to end. According to a new study out this week from the Institute of Medicine, by the year 2030, more than 40% of American adults will qualify as obese. And add in the overweight folks, and that accounts for somewhere around 68% of Americans. More than two-thirds of us are carrying around extra pounds, taxing our hearts, our livers, our healthcare system, and passing those bad habits on to our kids. So what is it going to take for us to slim down? That's one of the questions asked in a new documentary series called The Weight of the Nation. It will air on HBO starting next week. John Hoffman, vice president of HBO Documentary Films and the executive producer of The Weight of the Nation, is here with us on our New York studios. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Glad to be here.
Why HBO, an entertainment channel, tackling such a heavy issue, if I might put it that way?
Well, starting in 2007, when we aired Addiction, which was a co-presentation with the National Institutes of Health, and then we followed that with the Alzheimer's Project in 2009, also with the NIH, we tried to really establish ourselves as a place to really inform Americans about issues that are really important to their health and the health of the nation. And we are going against our model as being an entertainment company, and we're also going against our model when we're making this content available however we can, wherever we can, on all platforms. And it's corporate citizenship at its best when we're really using this invitation into 30 million homes to tell people important things about their health.
And you think you can succeed where everybody else has failed over the years in getting Americans to change their habits, their diets, whatever?
I don't know if succeeding is really something that we are aspiring to so much as sending up as many flares as possible and really igniting a conversation. It's going to take a long time to turn this around. It was rapid changes over 30 years, but I think to undo these tremendous changes in the culture that really in many ways play to our most basic pleasures in terms of responding to sugar, fat, and salt, and also being leisurely when we can to conserve energy. We have really advanced the technologies that enable us to live this way, and to ask people to go back is not something that we're going to do. We're going to have to think our way out of this in creative ways.
And you got some great names. I mean, very big time scientific names in here, including the Institute of Medicine, correct? That's probably the most respected place in all of America for doing science.
Well, we went to the IOM at the beginning of this when we really realized that it's not going to be solved. Obesity is not going to be solved by simple changes in the – I shouldn't say it that way. Really, it's not going to be solved by the changes that are going to be discovered in the laboratory. It's really going to be changes that happen in society. And the IOM has been looking at this for the past 10 years. And when they release a report, the ground shifts. And we recognize, and we saw that in the literature. And so we went to the IOM, we went to the NIH, went to the CDC, and we brought them all together to really make this concerted effort.
Mm-hmm. And did you get any cooperation of the food companies themselves?
We didn't. This is not a piece of journalism. This is a piece of public health. And so we really are informing people about all the issues that pertain to the health and future of this country. And we have a really unique character who is part of the IOM committee, Phil Marino, who's the former chairman and CEO of PepsiCo North America and Quaker Oats, who sat on this committee that we followed for 18 months as an industry representative. And he has a completely unique perspective, also being on the Kaiser Permanente Board of Directors, who really wears a lot of hats and has a combined set of experiences that really inform the series in terms of this intersection of industry and health.
And so you have a four-part series. Do you make recommendations? You study it. Then do you make recommendations about what Americans should be doing or a direction healthcare should go?
There are strong recommendations about what people can do in their daily lives. I think that the loudest one is that sugar-sweetened beverages, whether that be in juice, in sports drinks, in energy drinks, in sodas, that there is no reason for these to be in our lives. They are not something that were part of the human diet until recently, and we don't have the biology that knows how to compensate for those that fast rush of sugar. So we have many experts who say that this is the number one change that could happen in the human, in the American diet.
Do you go as far as to say they should be taxed, made more expensive than non-sweetened?
That issue is not brought up in the series. Mm-hmm. It's brought up in the IOM report that was just released this week at the Weight of the Nation conference.
Mm-hmm. What other steps do you recommend?
We have got to really renovate tremendous aspects of our culture, and it's going to take a tremendous amount of invention and tremendous amount of innovation to really re-engineer our lives. far too many people don't even have access to places to run, safe places to run, bike, or even walk. And when you have this problem in certain communities, in certain neighborhoods, you are really having people have a double or triple whammy working against them in terms of trying to lead healthy lives.
There's already been a bit of a backlash, a criticism, not only against the Institute of Medicine report. An op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today talked about the nanny state. I'm sure you're familiar with this. They're telling us what to eat again. They want to tell us everything, how we should live our lives. Do you talk about that in the series?
Well, you know, if we look to the government to make sure that our food supply is safe, mm-hmm. that we are not going to get sick with salmonella or E. coli, we rely on the government. We don't think of that as the nanny state to make sure that we don't get any kind of infectious bacteria from the food that we eat. Mm-hmm. I think that it's fair to argue, and many of the experts that we talk to would argue, that the food supply is making people sick because it's promoting diabetes, which is driving stroke and heart disease in this country. And so I think it's a fair discussion that has to go on mm-hmm. about the future health of this country as to whether the food supply is in fact safe.
I think one of the surprising things that I had known sort of peripherally being a science reporter all these years, but you pointed out very well in one of your pieces, is the effect that being overweight has on your liver. You don't think about your liver as being, affected.
I think that in part one of the series called Consequences, this is what people talk about more than anything. And this is the work of Sam Klein at Washington University in St. Louis. And the liver is in many ways the canary in the coal mine. And it is the people who have excess fat in their liver, 25% of Americans are walking around with excess fat in their liver right now, that when it reaches a tipping point, it is then what drives the spiking of cholesterol. It's the rise in the blood sugar. It's really the promoter of diabetes. And so Sam does a study that is striking in which a volunteer, a woman who courageously volunteers to add a fast food diet of 1,000 calories to her daily routine, and in just 10 weeks of that diet, her liver fat goes up by 161%. And so if the fatty liver is this canary in the coal mine, and this fast food diet that too many Americans are eating is promoting excess fat in the liver, then we really have what's coming as a tidal wave of liver disease.
You've been working on this for, 3 years now? Every producer goes in thinking one thing and then they get surprised by something. What was one of the great surprises that you discovered while working on this?
I think that the awareness that we are living in what we describe as a mismatch, that the genes that evolved in a time of scarcity and want are now existing in an environment of plenty, mm-hmm. and that our genetic makeup is just not designed for this current modern-day environment, and that no matter what we do, there's too many of us who are having responses to food that are operating below our awareness, and that when you have two-thirds of the population that is overweight or obese, you have to say that it's more than just a failure of personal will and responsibility. Something more powerful is going on, which is compelling people to eat a little bit more than they should and to move less than they should. And it's this evolutionary biology, which was the big aha for me.
It's also interesting that I think a lot of people avoid dieting or losing weight, let's put it that way. Eating correctly, they say, I'm just so fat, losing a few pounds is not going to make any difference. That's not true.
Not at all. And this is what is now coming online, I think, which the research is very powerful, that shows that a 7 to 10% weight loss, so if you're 200 pounds, that's 14 to 20 pounds. It's not 50 or 60 pounds that you have to lose. That 7 to 10% can have profound impacts on your metabolic health. And we hope, by sending out this message in these shows, and that message is repeated, we hope that people will find some comfort and some confidence that that is a weight loss that they could attain.
1-800-999-8255. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Ron in Louisville. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I've heard a lot of people talking about taxing sugar beverages and that type of thing, but I think a much better route, which would raise the cost of these things and get the votes of people who don't want to continue these farm subsidies, is we make grain so cheap, and corn is used to make high fructose corn syrup, and the subsidies make that extremely cheap. It also makes our meat a lot less healthy because of the feedlot beef being fed on corn is vastly different in its nutrition profile than grass-fed beef, which is what beef is supposed to be fed on. And so I think that you won't have the nanny state people going after you if you try to do away with subsidies. There are a lot of people who, and I mean, if you're taxing and then you're doing subsidies at the same time, well, you're spending twice as much money to accomplish nothing. Mm-hmm. And then it would just be better to do away with the subsidies to start with, and then you don't spend money on both.
Good point. In fact, the Institute of Medicine makes this point in one of its recommendations.
Yeah. The issue of the subsidies that are going out to farmers is fundamental to the discussion of the obesity crisis in this country. And we have got to really redistribute these farm dollars to enable a very different food supply to be produced and to give farmers the confidence to plant fruits and vegetables. Right now, less than 3% of American farmland is devoted to fruits and vegetables. More than 50% is devoted just to two crops, corn and soy. And so when you have this kind of imbalance, and which is almost entirely due to the confidence of the farmer to plant different crops, then we're not going to solve this problem. And the caller outlines it perfectly in terms of the food supply chain.
We're talking about this HBO documentary series coming up next week, The Weight of the Nation, airing on HBO. We're talking with John Hoffman on Science Friday from NPR. Four parts divided up into different ideas. Tell us about the parts.
Part one is called Consequences, and it outlines for the viewer the health effects on the body and talking about changes to the internal organs when you're carrying too much fat around the middle. It's changes in metabolism. It's the liver fat that we discussed earlier. And it talks about the extent of the problem in the population. Part two is Choices, and it really highlights the most evidence-based science about what we know about achieving weight loss and, more importantly, sustaining that weight loss. 95 to 98% of the population regains the weight they've lost within 5 years. But when you have a population as large as we have that has lost weight, then even that 5% is a large number of people, and those people have been studied, and we know what they do to sustain that weight loss, and those messages are in that part two challenges. Part three is Children in Crisis. It is a tremendous problem. Obviously, we know there's a lot of focus on childhood obesity. But the social determinants of what is driving this increase in weight in children have to be discussed. It's the marketing of unhealthy food to children. It's the unhealthy food that's being served to them in schools. It's the lack of physical activity. Less than 2% of children in high schools get physical activity every day. 4% of children in elementary schools. Mm-hmm. Yet the physical activity recommendations is an hour of vigorous activity every day. Part four is called Challenges, and it tries to look at from a high altitude about what are all the reasons that are driving this complex problem. And it then ends with, I think, some very inspiring stories of communities that are really now trying to recognize this and make the communities, Nashville in particular, a healthier place to live.
Will there be any distribution outside of HBO of this series?
Absolutely. And this is truly a public health campaign. We have wonderful partners, Kaiser Permanente and Michael and Susan Dell Foundation, that enabled this to go from public education to public health. The entire series, 12 short films that go along with it in English and in Spanish, are being distributed free of charge to 40,000 community-based organizations. This is an unprecedented level of grassroots distribution and organizing. There's a website which gives people over 75 actions that they can take to try to move the dial in their communities and in the nation. All this content is available in perpetuity on HBO.com. These screenings and kits are available to any organization that wants to organize a community by going to HBO.com.
You know, it seems like this is almost too good to be true. This kind of generosity that, you know, Viacom, HBO, whatever, giving out.
Time Warner.
Time Warner. who sat down and said, we should do this? Or does this go way to the top at Time Warner or HBO? Or?
It does start at the top in that.
I mean, this is so generous to give this stuff out and people who don't even subscribe to HBO.
You know, I work for a successful company, and it's every now and then we do have the ability to give back and to really show that HBO and Time Warner cares about the health of the country, and we have a powerful platform. And at the very beginning, you described us as an entertainment company, and that's what we are. But when we go against our model and when we turn our lens towards these complex social issues, then other media, you are a great example, notice it. And so we've recognized that when we go against our typical platform of presenting great entertainment and look at health, then we get the cooperation of a tremendous number of other media outlets, and it just magnifies the message.
Mm-hmm. And begins next week. What day?
Monday and Tuesday, 2 episodes a night starting at 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock. Thank you very much, John Hoffman.
Glad to be here.
He's Vice President of HBO Documentary Films, Executive Producer of Weight of the Nation, coming next week. And that means Boardwalk Empire will still be going on, right? Okay. We'll still get to see those shows. Also, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about a medical mystery, a stomach virus you don't want to have, but so many people get it. It's an interesting history and a mystery, so stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Got a hankering for a bit more conversation? You didn't like what you heard. You want to hear more of it? Well, you can keep the chat going at Science Friday's Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/SciFry. Or you can tweet us all week long at SciFry. That's at SciFry. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now, a medical mystery. About a stomach virus you don't want to get. Flora Lichtman is here with the story. Hope you've already had lunch. Flora?
Ira, this story is a little disgusting, but also scientifically significant. Here's the setup. A soccer team goes on the road to play a tournament. One member gets violently ill. She leaves the hotel along with the chaperone she was staying with before coming into any direct contact with the other players. Yet, a few days later, 7 other players get sick with the same virus. The mystery is, how did the virus spread without the sick girl? Well, Dr. Kimberly Rep cracked the case. Dr. Rep is an epidemiologist in Washington County, Oregon, and one of the authors of a paper in the Journal of Infectious Diseases describing the outbreak. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Rep.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Dr. Rep, did we miss anything important in that setup to this mystery?
No, that was beautiful. The work was done in conjunction with Dr. Bill Keene at the Oregon Health Authority, so we worked together on it.
Okay, so tell us how you solved it. What's the answer to this mystery?
Well, unfortunately, the chaperone had stored a bag of food in the bathroom where the first girl became ill, and the girl was ill for about 6 hours with vomiting and diarrhea. And completely unknown to her teammates, one of the other teammates, after she had already left, walked into the room, grabbed the bag with the food in it, and took it into the team room, and it was shared with the team, and that's how we believe they became ill.
Oh, the snacks.
Yes.
They seem so innocent.
It does. You know, they're just trying to help with cookies and grapes and packaged chips and great team snack, but unfortunately had a little bug on it.
And what bug are we talking about?
We are talking about norovirus.
And what is norovirus?
Norovirus is commonly referred to as stomach flu. It causes acute gastroenteritis. It's very contagious. It spreads easily. And the main thing we want to try and do is prevent secondary spread of infection.
So I guess the question is, how did it actually get on that bag?
Well, when people become violently ill, the virus is aerosolized and it lands. anywhere. So when you're in an enclosed space like a bathroom, like most of us are when we're ill, and the virus goes up in the air, it lands on the countertops, toothbrush, everywhere. And then if we don't clean those surfaces in that environment, we can transmit disease.
Well, how long can it stay on your toothbrush or your light switch and then still be contagious?
We have, there are varying reports on that, but it's estimated that at least 2 weeks the virus can stay alive on a normal surface.
2 weeks?
Yeah.
Wow. That makes you think twice about using a public restroom, or me anyway.
Well, usually most people don't become ill in a public restroom, right? So it's probably not as great a risk. But if someone is ill, we do know now that we should certainly be cleaning those environments with a proper bleach solution, 10-to-1 bleach solution.
Is it something special about norovirus that it can survive so long on, you know, outside of the human body or outside of a host?
It's a beautiful pathogen, and it knows how to spread itself very well by aerosolizing. That's why the onset is so extreme, and that's why a lot of people, unfortunately, pass away from the virus because they can't survive the onset. But the virus itself is a beautifully designed pathogen, and it's the most common foodborne illness.
What does it do when it's not in the body? Does it sort of hibernate? Do we know?
I don't think we have a lot of information on that because, quite frankly, we can't get it to grow in the lab.
Really?
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, we're working on it. Everybody, there are lots of very, very talented scientists working on that. But it's a special little pathogen.
And how much do you need to be exposed to? I mean, in the case of the outbreak you described, it seems like you didn't need much. I mean, these girls didn't need much to get sick.
Well, the norovirus actually has the lowest infectious dose of any virus known. It only takes 18 viral particles to get an infection, which is practically nothing when you think there are over a billion of the viruses in 1 gram of feces. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Only
18, yep.
Wow, and they can be on the counter for 2 weeks, and you can become infected. And then do you have to put your hands in your mouth or something? Do they need a special way in?
Yes, of course. The virus needs to gain entry into your body, but with most humans, touching their face and their eyes and rubbing their nose as often as we do, that's pretty trivial.
So for this study, did we know that this could happen? Did we suspect it?
Oh, absolutely. Everyone has suspected this for years and years and years. We've known that the norovirus can be aerosolized. That's been known. And we have been able to isolate norovirus from door handles and keyboards and various outbreaks. This is kind of just filling in the missing link between, is this actually possible to not have any contact with a sick person and still get sick just from touching an inanimate object?
Hmm. And it is.
It is, yep.
It is. So tell me a little bit about how you actually did this study. It sounds like there was a lot of detective work involved.
Yeah, we had a good time with this. We received a call from the state of Washington Health Department informing us that some Oregonians were sick, and it met the definition for a criteria for an outbreak, so we conducted a full investigation. Over the course of about 3 days, we interviewed all the healthy and sick people on the soccer team, all the chaperones. Washington State helped interview other teams that were at the soccer tournament to see how big it was. There was a lot of work from a lot of people on this. And from interviewing the players, we were able to determine that these prepackaged cookies were associated with illness. And from determining it was the cookies and what the cookies were in, we were able to put the piece together. But it took 3 interviews with the team players to actually get out the information that somebody had gone into the bathroom and retrieved the bag.
I bet they felt bad about that.
Oh, it was horrible. I was speaking to the person, and she started putting it together. She's like, oh no, it's the bag, isn't it? It's my fault. I'm like, no, we're not. We don't know anything yet. We're just trying to put this together. And, oh, yeah, you could see her connecting the dots, and she was upset, of course.
Do you take physical evidence, too? Do you swab things and stuff like that?
The only physical evidence in this case, besides the stool specimens provided by the players, was the actual bag involved in the outbreak. And I retrieved that 2 weeks after the outbreak, and our wonderful lab quickly ran it and was able to isolate a virus from the bag, but we were unable to determine if it was infectious or not.
So is this what epidemiology is all about? Is it really like a sort of detective work type of field?
Absolutely. I think this is the really, really, really fun part of epidemiology, and this is what makes us public health people love our jobs.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, it really is mystery work. If you want to get in on this conversation, our number is 1-800-989-TALK, 1-800-989-TALK. So is there something else about are there other viruses like norovirus in their robustness or their ability to – could you find other things on the light switch, I guess?
I am sure you could. I'm not necessarily familiar with any other viruses that can do it to this extent. This is the method of transmission for this bug. It likes to be airborne. It likes to land. And that's basically – it's pretty unique in that way. There are lots of other foodborne illnesses that are associated with bacteria, but not necessarily a lot of other viruses.
Our number is 1-800-989-8255. So when you're not working on norovirus, what do you do usually?
obsessively clean my house. No, I'm a big dog person, so I like to read and hang out with my family and be with my dog.
So what do you suggest for people who are hear about this outbreak and they're like, oh, well, you know, grossed out and worried? What's the suggestion?
Well, the first number one take-home message is don't ever store food in your bathroom. I know that goes without saying, but it's probably just, you know, sometimes we don't think about it and we might bring something into the bathroom and leave it there, but just don't do that. And secondly, if someone has become ill in your household, if possible, isolate them to one bathroom or keep all the sick people in one bathroom. That will also help stop secondary transmission. And third, clean it properly. You know, don't just wipe down the toilet like we all do. Get out the bleach solution and wipe down the countertops. Throw away things that you can replace easily, and then you'll be okay.
Has this made you an obsessive cleaner? I mean, were you serious about that?
I have a PhD in microbiology, which requires obsessive compulsive disorder to actually get that, I think. So no, this didn't make me any worse.
Are there other viruses that you study?
No, actually, I shouldn't say that. We just had another paper in the Journal of Infectious Disease this month for the human papillomavirus and its association with condom use in men in an international cohort study.
Dr. Epp, thank you so much for taking time to be with us. This was a fascinating study. I have to say, of all the scientific papers I've read, none of them have read quite so much like a detective case than this.
Thank you.
Dr. Kimberly Rep is an epidemiologist for Washington County in Oregon and the co-author of this paper in the Journal of Infectious Diseases, A Point Source Norovirus Outbreak Caused by Exposure to Fomites. That is the trashy sound of the garbage men, Ira.
Oh, that's not very nice, trashy.
No, no, I mean it literally. It's literally picked out of the trash. The garbage men is a band of five high school kids from Florida, and they make their instruments, the ones that you're hearing them playing, with stuff that they rescue from the trash or even find on the side of the road. So, you know, no need to spend big bucks on a Stratocaster when you can use an empty Fruit Loops box, a yardstick, and some duct tape. No drum kit? How about a 5-gallon bucket and a trash can lid? E-flat contrabass bugle? You get the idea. So joining me now to talk about this is the band and their signature recycled sound is Jack Barry. He's the guitar player for the Garbage Men, and also with me is Ollie Gray. That's the band's drummer. They're both students at Pine View School in Osprey, Florida. Welcome to Science Friday, guys.
Hi. Hello.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us. Yeah, great to be on.
Well, let's talk about these instruments. Why don't you give us a run through of the instruments you play and what they're made of?
All right. Well, I'm Jack, and I play the guitar, which is a one-string guitar made from a Cheerios cereal box with a yardstick for the neck and toothpicks for frets. Then we have Ollie over here.
Yeah, I play the drums. I have a big black trash can for my bass drum. It's a big plastic trash can. My cymbals are two metal trash can lids. And for my tom drum, I use a water jug, and that's placed upside down in a bucket for maximum sound. We also have saxophone made from a kid's toy and a balloon.
Ooh, I want to hear more about that in just one second. You're listening to Science Friday on NPR. I'm Flora Lichtman with Ira Flato, and the Garbage Men, high school students who have this awesome band where they play instruments made from recycled material. So tell me about the saxophone.
Well, it's made from a Fisher-Price corn popper toy, and that makes up the body. It kind of looks like a saxophone. And we took a old PVC pipe, drilled some holes in it for the sound, and then for the reed, we used part of a balloon.
Ooh.
So it's kind of like a kazoo, but it sounds like a saxophone.
You can, by the way, see a video of the Garbage Men on our website at sciencefriday.com. It's definitely, definitely worth a look. I think you're rocking out at a farmer's market in it. Does that sound right, guys? So where did the idea for this come from? Who started this band?
Well, originally Jack had made a guitar out of a cereal box in the yardstick, and he had brought it to school to show some people. And I thought that that was just a really great idea, so I told him that I thought it would be nice if we made an entire band out of instruments like these, just to, like, see what we could make for, like, each instrument. And that really just blossomed into what it is today. Like, I think back then there were 3 instruments, and now we have, I'd say 8 off the top of my head.
Jack, where did you get the idea for that initial guitar?
Well, I mean, I just wanted to build myself an instrument, and those were the materials I had lying around. I didn't go out thinking, hey, wouldn't it be cool to make a band out of garbage, but it just kind of turned out that way because those are the things I had lying around the house.
Is there a piece of garbage you'd like to have that you haven't garbage picked yet?
Well, I've been looking for some cool-shaped things that kind of look like other instruments.
I've been looking for a metal mailbox that won't fall apart after, like, 1 gig, because those have the ultimate sound.
Okay, well, if anyone in your neighborhood is listening, maybe
they
could donate. Ira, you could get a Science Friday mailbox. So have the instruments changed much? Have you learned anything about making these instruments since you began?
Yeah, definitely. I've learned through trial and error with making the instruments. The very first guitar I made, the neck was really bendy and it couldn't stay in tune. But through trial and error, making different instruments, they've definitely improved. The very first saxophone we made actually didn't work that well because the balloon started to vibrate at a different overtone than it normally would have. But we fixed that so it didn't squeak anymore.
Oh, nice. Do you guys play gigs?
Yeah, every weekend we do.
Yeah, every weekend.
So where's your next gig so we can come see it?
Ooh. Well, we're actually playing at a festival in Tampa, in Ybor City, Tampa, Florida. It's called Tropical Heat Wave.
Very cool.
Wow.
Yeah. Have you played? What do people at school think? Are people trying to get in on the band?
Not really. They don't think much of it because, like, I mean, it's not really that big or, like, showy or anything like that, like a lot of other bands at school are with some other people in them. But definitely there are some people that like it, though, and, well, no one's really invested enough interest to, like, want to be in it or anything along those lines. Definitely there is, like, at least a small bit of support. Right.
We'll wait to see it on Glee soon. We'll know you've made it.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. I think they're going to play us out today, Ira. Jack Berry and Ollie Gray are 2 of the members of the Garbage Men Band, and look for them in front of the Whole Foods in Sarasota on May 19th. Or if you want to schedule upcoming gigs, go to their website. You'll find some links to their schedule, and we have all the info on our website at sciencefriday.com. Thanks, guys, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Flora. And that's about all the time we have for today. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora is our multimedia editor. Associate senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Namisha Sarananan is our producer. Luis Quevedo is our Spanish language producer. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Neil Rauch, our technical director at the controls here in New York. Our iPhone app produced by Pastime Software. Wayne Hoxie does our Android app. And holy mackerel, go over to our website. Something's happened to it. Whoa, you won't recognize it. It's an all-new, updated website, and we'd love to hear your comments about it and enjoy it. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.